Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
So I've been volunteering at Joy 94.9 for about 2 years. And look, I'd love to say that I came for the most altruistic of reasons, but I didn't. I actually thought, well, I really want to get into radio. I really want to find out how my voice goes. And I thought, well, I'll go and do the Joy training course. And I came along and I was captured by the people. Not literally, you understand, but well, kind of literally, because they won me over. I started to work with Chris and Cam on CNC Drive Factory, which I absolutely loved. I learnt so much from them, from Leanie back in the day. I learnt from the lovely Jason in production, the heavenly Josh. Everybody just sort of combined to give me this sort of knowledge and skills base. Then I got a drive show with Dano and I've loved it ever since. And I love the support I get at Joy. I love giving back to the community. I love it when young people get involved in our show and we get to help mentor them and in turn we get to learn from them. I love the environment at Joy and I really encourage you, if you're thinking about volunteering, to get on board. You don't have to be on air. We welcome all the support we can get, and thanks everybody that's been a part of this journey for me. I've really loved it, and keep listening to Joy.
It's Tuesday the 22nd of May. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Darcy Meehan. This week is National Volunteer Week, an annual celebration to acknowledge the generous contribution of our nation's volunteers. Here at Joy, we have over 300 volunteers, both on the mics and behind the scenes, helping to keep us out loud and proud. And the one you just heard from was Dee Mason, who hosts the Glow Show podcast, as well as Thursday's Drive. Tonight on the show, we unpack the findings of Vic Police Report, exploring how Victoria Police can meet the needs of our LGBTI communities, as well as build greater awareness within the force, after they revealed that 95% of those surveyed said that they wouldn't report a prejudice-motivated crime to police. And with the leader of Victoria's Liberal Party saying that they won't be adopting the Nordic model for policing sex work legislation, we find out where we need to go in order to create a fair working environment with the Vixen Collective.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
On Thursday, May 17th, Victoria Police published the findings of a report into police and young LGBTI people's perception of each other. 58% of young LGBTI people surveyed said they didn't believe police understand young LGBTI people's issues, with a mixed level of trust in police on various measures. Almost 95% of young LGBTI respondents had experienced some sort of discriminatory abuse in their lifetime, but only half indicated that they'd report a prejudice-motivated crime to police. There were 20 recommendations that the report made to Victoria Police under the four key themes: leadership, capacity, building, GLOWS, the LGBTI liaison officers, and reporting processes. Some of the recommendations were to provide a more visible police presence at young LGBTI people's events, increase training on LGBTI issues for recruits, current officers and senior police, promote the role of GLOWS to increase awareness in LGBTI communities, consider recruitment strategies to increase LGBTI diversity within Victoria Police. Rachel Tyler-Jones and Dina Curie sat down with the Priority Communities Division Commander Stuart Bateson and unpacked the findings of the report, exploring how Victoria Police can meet the needs of the LGBTI communities, as well as building greater awareness within the force.
Victoria Police has launched a report that provides insight into police and young LGBTI people's perceptions of one another. Can you tell us what prompted this research in the first place?
Well, I think it's important. You know, we've been doing a lot of work with the LGBTI community over a number of years to try and build trust. You know, our relationship has been strained over the years, but it was worthy to check in and just see how we were going. And we wanted to to do that, particularly with young people. Unfortunately for us, I guess it's brought back some really alarming results, not least of which is that 94% of the people surveyed said they had experienced some sort of abuse in their lifetime. And we're talking about young people between the ages of 16 and 25.
So how exactly did you go about getting the results?
So almost 80 young Victorians aged 16 to 25 participated in the online survey. Then we actually held a number of focus groups and interviews that took place across two regional Victorian sites. We also, as part of that survey, interviewed 360 officers. They actually responded to a survey rather than interviewed.
So it was on both sides of the coin?
Both sides of the coin. And what we found from the police point of view is that many of our officers lacked confidence. They were unsure how to communicate confidently with people from the LGBTI community. So that was an important learning for us as well.
Just roughly, what were the key findings? You've mentioned two of them, but if we just break it down for our listeners, what were the key findings that you found in the results?
So almost 60% of our frontline staff said they had received no training on LGBTI issues, and about 80% said they'd never consulted a GLO. So that was very problematic for us. However, 42% of the young people surveyed said that they would not be confident in going to police to report victimisations. They said that confidence increased when they actually dealt with a GLO. So our GLO program's really important. We've extended that to 260 officers across the state, but we need to support those officers to be more confident and to use them to train and provide information to our frontline staff as well.
Could you maybe just tease that out for us a little bit and tell us what GLO stands for and what it takes to become a GLO officer?
So GLO has become more of a brand than anything else, but it's our LGBTI liaison officer network. So we've started those back in the early 2000s, and really it's just a person that is able to confidently interact and people from the LGBTI community can know, well, yes, they understand my issues and they'll be able to help me. And that's an important part for that.
You're listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9, and we're speaking to Commander Stuart Bateson from Victoria Police. One of the really interesting things is the fact that 60% of your frontline staff hadn't consulted a GLO and didn't know what to do in these scenarios, because the GLO is an absolutely brilliant initiative. We're very familiar with it here at Joy. Mm. We see them a lot when we're, you know, the GLOs are out at festivals, they're out at LGBTI venues. But kind of when you look at that research and realise that internally people aren't reaching out to GLOs, so it maybe, was that result what you were expecting?
No, that was surprising to us, and I think that really showed somewhere where we can improve, because our GLOs have been, as you said, really good at reaching out to the community and being visible and present and building trust with community, but they haven't necessarily looked inwards and seen how they could help, and nor have we actually pushed them into that space. So I think now that we've sort of got this result, we can say, hey, how can we actually build that relationship not only between the GLOs and the community, but the GLOs and other police? And that's certainly going to be a focus for us over the next few years.
So when you were all looking at these results and seeing what they were these the results that you were expecting from something like this?
Look, I guess it surprised me in particular that only, you know, just under half of young people said they'd report victimisation to us, that they would trust us enough to do that. I would have thought that would be higher. So, yes, that did surprise me. But when I talked to community members, it was no surprise to them. So I think that's the importance of doing research like this, to make sure that we understand the issues of the community and then respond to them. Because we perhaps thought we were doing a little bit better than that, and it shows we've got some real work in front of us.
Do you think that some of that hesitance to come forward is actually because the prejudice-motivated crime that they're talking about or considering in those situations is almost thought to be too everyday or too minor to be to report?
Look, perhaps, but it was also a really interesting finding that they didn't think that Victoria Police views, even though they didn't feel that they could always trust them, differed too much more than their general community. So that was an interesting thing as well. So not only have we got work to do within Victoria Police, I think it's an issue that the community need to grapple with as well, and just how important it is for young people from the LGBTI community to feel that they're valued. And I think that's the importance of being able to report victimisation, that when they come forward, their story will be respected and will be valued for what it is.
In regards to the survey and in regards to the findings and what we're talking about now, what exactly do you quantify as victimisation?
Well, it's interesting. That wasn't clearly spelt out in the survey and the question, so it was left to the definition of the person answering the survey. So, you know, I think victimisation is different for different people. But from my perspective, if you feel like you're being victimised, then that's real enough and that's damaging enough. And, you know, even if it may well be harassment that falls short of breaking the law, we want that information because we know that, you know, homophobic and transphobic commentary can often be a precursor to violence. So that kind of intelligence help us to deliver, you know, increased patrols in areas where it's happening.
You're on The Informer on Joy 94.9, and we're speaking with Commander Stuart Bateson from Victoria Police. So I guess now the next step is to figure out a way to get that message out to the community. So what steps are Victoria Police planning or thinking about taking after looking at these results to improve your relationship with young LGBTI people?
So the recommendations within the report are pretty clear. So there's talk around leadership, and I think that's a really important part within Victoria Police that we're really working towards. So it's about making sure that our senior leaders and our police station commanders understand the importance of being visible and available and understanding and listening to the experiences of young people from the LGBTI community. There's also a little bit about expanding our GLOW network and making sure that they're much more visible and involved in community events. And there's also a little bit about training, you know, giving our frontline members the confidence to interact with the community. And that's certainly going to be where we concentrate our efforts over the next 12 months.
It kind of sounds like a whole rounding approach. Like, really, when you break it down that way, it does really sound like on every single side of this issue, we really need to do some work.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's also work that needs to happen in the community. This is not just a policing issue. It's really about the community come to grips. And, you know, it's interesting. I did some media last week and some of the commentary and the feedback coming back on social media, I think really speaks to, you know, the victimisation that some of these young people from the community had suffered over time and really calls out that this is an issue that's bigger than the police and something that I think we need leaders right across the community to step up and say enough. We're just not going to stand for it anymore.
Going back to what you were talking about with some of these maybe more minor crimes or the harassment that's maybe not yet a criminal offence, could you just talk us through how you would go about reporting a prejudice-motivated crime and what happens when you do?
So a prejudice-motivated crime is any crime that's motivated by prejudice. So it might be an assault, it might be a criminal damage. And when we actually see that's been motivated by hate or by prejudice, that allows us to charge on that extra category, and it also involves further sentencing options for the magistrate or judge. So that's an important part to call out. But, you know, also, as I said, you know, when it falls short of a criminal offence, but it's still homophobic, it's still transphobic, and it's still hateful, that's the kind of information that we need. And this is where I say to the community, we need that information reported into our GLOWs, because if it's happening regularly in certain places, then we need to step up our patrols and put a stop to it.
On a very practical level, how would you go about getting that information to the GLOWs?
So ring them is probably the best, and we've got a list of our GLOWs on our website, so that would probably be the best case scenario, or go in and see them in the police stations. I should also say that one of the more effective ways, if you want to remain anonymous, is to call Crime Stoppers, and they'll record that information for us.
I I guess as I'm listening to this, I guess one of the things, one of the interesting things is really I'm still coming back to the frontline staff and how they felt in regard to this scenario. If we're creating a space, even though you are working on improving and the breadth of the GLOW program and what that means for our community, if we're creating a space where go to a GLOW instead of going to any other police officer, are you concerned about what that message might mean for further disenfranchising within both the police force and the community?
Yeah, I think that's really a good point. And, you know, we hope we're not in that position another 6 or 12 months. But, you know, if we've got people that are experiencing that kind of homophobic, transphobic commentary, the best persons to go to at this point is GLOWs. And hopefully in 12 months, 18 months, you could go to any police officer and they would say, yes, I know that's not a crime, but I'm going to take some action anyway.
I know what to look for the GLOWs. I know what the abbreviation is. But for someone else in our community, being able to just search online and find where that is isn't necessarily something that's as easy to do. Is there a possible steps to be able to create better avenues for people to access the information so they can contact the GLOWs?
Absolutely. And you know, one of the other recommendations from the report was, you know, how can we develop other methods of reporting, and that's something that we've got to look at, where people can remain anonymous and report those minor infringements or offensive commentary. So that's a challenge for us too, but at this point in time, that the GLOWs are the best contact. But we do have to make them more visible. But if you go to the website, you'll find a list of them.
This isn't the results that anyone was expecting. We've certainly, there's been a lot of work that's been done. There's been a lot of work on many levels. But of course, suddenly when we look at these results, it kind of confirms what perhaps a lot of young people have been saying. So there is work that we have to do on every side of this. But what is the main thing that you would like to let the LGBTI community of Victoria know so that we can start to kind of build these bridges and work towards a better communication?
Well, I think the most important thing is that your experience, and if you are a victim of crime, please report it. You know, we will take that report seriously and we will take action. And if you're not satisfied with the service you get from the police, you should be highlighting that to the local managers or through the complaint system. But I encourage you to speak to a GLOW and gain their trust and talk to them about those issues.
Thank you for joining us on The Informer, Commander Stuart Bateson from the Victoria Police.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
When the Victorian Liberal Party passed a motion to support the Nordic model of sex work regulation in Victoria, many sex workers and advocates spoke out saying that employing the Nordic model is a step in the wrong direction. The Nordic model criminalises paying for sex but doesn't criminalise the sex worker, which would mean that in Victoria, buying sex, pimping and keeping a brothel would all be against the law should a law based off the Nordic model come into place. Currently in Victoria, it is only illegal for clients to solicit sex in a public place. The act itself is not illegal. Leader of the Liberal Party, Matthew Guy, stated in Victorian Parliament that the Liberal Nationals have no plan to adopt the Nordic model for policing of sex work in Victoria. Dina Curie and Tom Morgan sat down with Jane Green from Victoria's peer-only sex workers organisation, the Vixen Collective, about what's next in creating better legislation for Victoria's sex workers.
For our listeners, can you just set the stage for what the reality is for sex workers right now in Victoria and the law?
Absolutely. Well, at the moment in Victoria, we have what's called a licensing system, and it can be difficult for people to get their heads across the different models of sex work regulation. In New South Wales, for example, sex work is decriminalised, and the best way to understand decriminalisation is that criminal laws relating to sex work are removed, so that sex work is regulated just like other work. And obviously that's what's preferable for sex workers, because at the end of the day we want to be treated like other workers, have the same access to our rights and have our health and safety supported as other workers do in the community. Here in Victoria, in contrast, under licensing, some but not all of the criminal laws relating to sex work have been removed. So, for example, street-based sex work is still criminalised, and over the top of having some of those laws criminalising our work removed, introduced a system of regulating how, when, where and with who we can can work, and it's a very complicated system of laws, and they fit across four different acts and regulations in Victoria. And if you're in breach of any of that, if you're not complying with the licensing system at any time, then you're also criminalised. And obviously that has significant impacts on sex workers, on our rights, and importantly on things like our ability to access assistance from police if we are subject to violence in our work.
A lot of awareness has been raised since the conversation of the Nordic model was put on the table, with the fact that the laws that we currently have in place in Victoria do seem a little backdated in regards to the rights of sex workers. Even though there were calls that the Nordic model was moving in the wrong direction, we're now left with the status quo. So are we happier with no change in regard to the current legislation in Victoria, or is there need for a change?
There's absolutely need for a change. And look, sex workers, representative organisations, health, human rights organisations worldwide, and long-term evidence of the effects of different types of sex work regulation show that full decriminalisation of sex work is what best supports our rights, health and safety. So that's where we should be moving to in Victoria. And the licensing system itself is intrinsically harmful for us. I certainly think that when there's a push to the Nordic model, for Victorian sex workers, that's like going from the frying pan into the fire. Neither are good, but the Nordic model is catastrophic. Now that we've had this commitment from Matthew Guy on behalf of the Liberal Nationals that they have no plan to adopt the Nordic model, that's reassuring to sex workers in Victoria, but it's not enough. We need all political parties to support human rights of members of our community, and importantly, to consult with us prior to the introduction of policy or law that affects our lives and work.
So depending on the area one works in, what resources are there for sex workers currently to help ensure that they do keep right within this current framework of law? And is there more there that should be done in the meantime?
Victorian sex workers are in a very unique position in Australia, because Victoria is the only state out of all the states and territories in the country that does not have a funded peer sex worker service. So Vixen, the organisation that I represent, has now in its 13th year of operation as an unfunded volunteer service. Now, obviously that impacts the level of services that we can do within our own community, and that's not a good position, and we shouldn't be put in that position, especially when we're the only state that exists in this way. So in Victoria, the licensing system actually impacts our lives, and particularly our health and safety, in very negative ways. And negative ways that evidence clearly shows over a long period of time in Australia shouldn't be the case. So, for example, we have mandatory testing for STIs and HIV here in Victoria, yet the epidemiology on that shows that sex workers have lower rates of STIs and higher compliance with condom use than members of the general public. We don't need to be told to go and get tested, and we don't need to be monitored in that way, because it's part of our health that we maintain on an ongoing basis. And organisations like Vixen Collective and other peer organisations in Australia do peer education and outreach on that basis. But what's critical about that is by forcing people into a system where they have to get tested every 3 months and they have to produce an attendance certificate saying that that's occurred to work in a Victorian workplace, that puts people in a situation where they either have to out themselves to their GP or medical provider. And obviously people can face discrimination on the basis of being a sex worker because of the stigma involved in our work, but also it compiles medical records on sex workers, and that's not helpful for us in terms of potential future discrimination. Now, there is one anonymous testing service in the entire state of Victoria, and that's Melbourne Sexual Health, which is in Swanston Street here in the city. But obviously we can't have an expectation that all sex workers are going to be able to access their anonymous service, and also regional and rural sex workers are specifically disadvantaged. And the pushing sex workers through that service, when we are a low incidence population for STIs and HIV, draws resources away from other segments of the population that do need those resources provided to them.
Jane, do you feel that now that this conversation has kind of gotten out there in this way, and we've had in Parliament it get said the Nordic model is not something that's being implemented, do you think this is leading to an opportunity to shed greater light on meeting the needs of the industry and the workers within it, or people will just ignore it once again?
Look, I think it's created a conversation in media beyond sex worker community with allies and supporters of our community because of the level of concern over the Liberal Party support for Nordic model laws, but it needs to be bigger conversations, and sex workers' voices need to be predominant in that conversation. I know as a media representative for Vixen Collective that it's very difficult to get sex workers' voices in media, and our lives are often discussed without us being party to that discussion. And that's not acceptable for any marginalised community. It's certainly not acceptable for ours.
Now, there are two important things that have come out of Matthew Guy's statement. It's highlighted that you can stand up for a proposed law that further marginalises, alienate and threatens the livelihoods of people, but also the importance of policymakers hearing from the communities before they try to move forward with laws. So how do you think we can engage more on a political level to create a safer and more level playing field within Victoria's sex worker industry?
Well, I mean, sex workers and sex workers' representative organisations perpetually make submissions to government on these issues, have conversations where possible with political parties and leaders of those parties. But I think what's problematic about that effort is it's a continual fight on our part to be let into those spaces and to get a seat at the table when those discussions are happening. And often we've been specifically excluded from processes where our work and our lives are being discussed in terms of policy and law. There needs to be an impetus on political parties and on government to consult with all marginalised communities in law and policy relating to their lives. And it's certainly not sex workers, but we're not the only community affected by that failure. It's indicative of a larger failure by government to consult with marginalised people and their representative organisations.
So speaking on behalf of your organisation, what would you like to see happen now?
The full decriminalisation of sex work in Victoria. Very clearly that's what's needed. All political parties should base their policy on supporting the human rights and labour rights of all members of the community here in Victoria, and failing to recognise the full criminalisation of sex work as a necessary step to achieving that is a failure to recognise sex work as human rights, and that shouldn't be acceptable. Human rights are for everyone. We don't have to qualify for them. We shouldn't have to make an argument to get them. We get them because we're human beings. And politicians and political parties that fail to recognise that are failing us.
Jane Green from the Vixen Collective, thank you for joining us on The Informer.
Absolute pleasure.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you the news and current affairs from Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platforms. Don't forget to follow us on social media, at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. Remember, this week is National Volunteers Week, and we want to give a big shout out to the team on air and behind the scenes here at The Informer, bringing current affairs for your communities, keeping our voices out loud and proud. You've been listening to The Informer. I'm Darcy Meehan.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.